candid conversations that might just change how you look at the world. Let's bridge cultures, transcend borders, and build a global family of changemakers. Welcome to If by Chance.
Journaling has long been touted as something that's good for our mental health. But for some, it can feel heavy and a little too real. So in this episode, Louise shares micro-poetry as an alternative and why it's easier than you might think.
I do a workshop on processing your trauma through poetry or healing through poetry, managing your emotions. It's kind of, you can pitch it whatever way is necessary for the group. But essentially, we just kind of start off with, I need you, there'll be like a prompt word, say it's bird. And you'll say, you know, like, just write me a sentence about a bird. Like, you don't expect people to actually talk about their trauma in a poetry workshop. So it's just about getting the tools to kind of do it. But so you can write just a really normal sentence. Don't try to write a poem. Don't try and do anything. Just write, like, I was in my garden and I saw a bird. That's a sentence about a bird. And then we kind of expand on it and say, okay, well, try and add metaphor in it, or try and add adjective in it, or try and add feeling into it. So then it's, well, I saw a bird and I couldn't help but wonder if he felt free, or something, you know, and you kind of add this into it, and then you can just kind of build on it that way, and you kind of keep making it a bit more, and then you have to make it smaller again, and that's it, so that you have like your micro and you can kind of learn to eliminate the pieces that are unnecessary. Or actually you can learn like the power of adding a seemingly unimportant word and the way the inflection changes if you put in an and or a just or a, you know, like, so. But it's actually like, it's very simple, and I've been fortunate in terms of poetry in that it genuinely is, my brain just kind of sounds like that all of the time, which is potentially a lot. I'm not sure everybody would want to think that way, but that's where I'm at.
Do you think that the power with poetry is that for the most part you're writing in the third person and almost creating a parallel universe?
I think it does help. Like, I think when you read, and in when I've written my books, I have like every 20 or so pages, I'll have like a little space and there'll be a word definition on one side and then like a note page on the other side. And there's space for you to write down what you're feeling, because I've always noticed when I read a poetry book, I end up with notes scribbled all down the margins, ideas, thoughts, feelings, memories, all of the things. And I think the thing with poetry is that it is designed to make you feel something, like whether that's joy, whether that's grief, whether that's whatever it is, it's almost always a very emotional thing to read. So when you read a book especially and you consume a lot of it in one go, it can feel very heavy. And I think that writing in the third person especially like helps you to take the weight off of you and change the perspective just a little bit when you put it down on a piece of paper, which gives you kind of like a bit of distance so you can view it and examine it with curiosity rather than feeling overwhelmed by it, which is, yeah, I definitely find that helpful. You get kind of braver, I think, the more I've gone along. Initially, I only wrote she, but, you know, like there's an I now, or a he and I, we, like as you get more comfortable in the vulnerability of it. But certainly I would have started from a place of she this and she that, and never, it wasn't my experience directly. Except it was.
Have you managed to build out your life differently since you've become more involved with poetry? Do you find yourself gravitating to different situations or different people than before?
I think it's hard to quantify, because I've been on my own now for like 6 years, and my previous marriage was an abusive one, so I was very isolated. So I had like nobody essentially most of the time. I think like my best friends and my closest circle aren't necessarily people who are or aren't involved in like their creativity or a creative endeavor of some kind, but that when you kind of widen that out to the next circle, the kind of wider group of people in my life are generally creative, and they talk the way I think, and that helps. And they write music or they act, or, you know, and so they're very in tune with their feelings, and they're poetry fans. Obviously, you have to be a poetry fan of some description to be in my life, unless we're related, in which case you absolutely think I'm an alien and don't know what to do.
And I'm just wondering if with poetry it creates a space for you to develop your own identity.
That has been
so
probably the biggest part of it. Having so my creativity, I think, was my like I think the first part of me to die in that situation. And so then like rediscovering it and examining poetry allows you to examine not only what you like but what you don't like, and to write it all out in these little kind of ways and figure out what you want and what you don't want. And I've definitely think it's been instrumental in me kind of rediscovering who it is that I am, especially when you write about love and you think, well, I don't want to depress everybody all the time, so I can't only write about my relationships. And then you start thinking, well, what do I want? What is healthy? What is actually a good thing to have in a relationship? And then you kind of force yourself to grow that way, because you can't hide from the things and you can't just let them unfold. You actually have to be like an active participant in figuring them out. And so there's a lot that way. And it's good also, like I go to counseling once a week, and I occasionally, like after a session, there'll be a thought and I'll be like, okay. And then it'll pop up later on in a poem and I'm like, oh, like there it is. And it's very expansive. Like I've found that I think I've grown a lot differently and maybe quicker and smoother because I have this way that I'm able to kind of work out all of the different aspects of what it is that's going on with me.
I'm thinking of it a little bit like a vision board as well. Do you see poetry in that way?
Like a vision, again, like it with a vision board, like it helps you because you can, you know, like if you're aiming for something and you can see it, like that makes so much difference in, like, I forget what the statistics are, but the rate of success is considerably higher if you have actually put something down that you can see. And I think it is similar, like actually writing it out makes it more solid somehow. And then especially when you get to the stage, like it's in a book, and I have a book full of my hopes and dreams and thoughts and feelings and my trauma and my, you know, like everything that there is about me, and I can hold that in my hands. And so, well, if I've written it and I've said it, like kind of got to see it through now. So I think it does work that way. And it helps you to kind of map out the different, you can write this one thing and then you can write a different thing. And then when you look at them side by side, or when you're thinking about putting a book together, then the things that you thought weren't necessarily connected, you find actually go hand in hand with one another as well. So it helps you kind of mind map it, almost like one of those little Sherlock Holmes situations.
And do you think people need to have a natural talent when it comes to writing poetry, or is it something
you can learn? No, I think anyone can do it. Honestly, and I don't want to like sell myself short or like, but I genuinely think that anybody can. It's just a different way of thinking. And that's very much a learned skill. Like if you naturally thought a certain way, which certainly helps, it made it easier. I didn't have to learn in the same way, but there's nothing about what I have learned about it and what I have explored myself that I think you couldn't learn to do no matter how your brain works. It's very doable.
For people that have children that really aren't that way inclined, is there any way that we can encourage them to be creative and to write poetry in a fun way? Like when I think back to English classes, they weren't really that much fun.
No, do you know what? It's difficult when it comes to education, isn't it? Like I'm involved with a youth organization that primarily helps to keep teenagers out of gangs and to understand their hopes and their aspirations and to kind of give them something bigger to focus on. So then, which, you know, like is the motivation. It's that kind of, if I get into trouble, then all of these things I actually want are going to be really, really hard for me, and gives you something else to look at. But Perry, who set that up, he says all the time, like significant learning only comes through significant relationship. So I think that's difficult. I mean, our school systems are massively overburdened for the most part. And there's 30 kids in a class, the chances are the teacher doing 6 classes a day is going to be burnt out, which does make it hard. But I think it also makes it so important when you do get those outside organizations that come in to just run like the one-off workshops, music days and arts days and like English days. Because, yeah, and I think it's just having somebody, it's not so much, I think, that it's boring, but having somebody that genuinely believes in that subject and has a passion for it makes a lot of difference when you're learning, especially when you're like a teenager. And I think being able to do something like poetry that's expressive, and if you can learn to connect with your emotions, and let's be honest, like by the time just being a teenager is generally quite traumatic for most of us. There's an awful lot of learning about who you are in the world and how you want to show up and what you want to be and all of these things, and processing everything that's happened in your life up to this point and all of the intense hormones. Like if you can begin something like micropoetry and learning to process all of that at that age in a way that doesn't feel like, oh, it's just for an exam at the end of it, but that actually feels like you can understand that you're developing a set of tools that will help you to succeed at life. That's, I think that's the key with children and like inspiring them, but it's not easy. It's very much dependent on, I think, outside funding and independent people being able to come in and share what it is that they love.
In, how do you frame it when you're working with teens in that situation?
They want to talk to you and they want an adult to listen to them and they want to feel seen and heard and respected and valued. And so you can, with teenagers, for the most part, you can prompt them. Like you can say, okay, well, you know, like I said before, this is the word we're going to use. Come on, any sentence you want, you're not going to get in trouble. I don't care if you swear in that sentence. I don't care if it's horrifically like inappropriate sentence. I don't care if it's a violent sentence. You do what makes you happy. And if you want to take this opportunity to push the boundaries and be silly or be funny or be inappropriate, because that's what you need right now, that's fine. You go ahead, you do that. And then we just do it step by step. But I think with teenagers, it's mostly just making them feel like they have agency in the situation. Like they're not just sat down and told, you're going to write this and you're going to learn this and then I'm going to mark it and then you're going to get points. And, you know, it's the, actually, this is about you. And if you want to engage with it authentically, that's great. If you want to just play about with it, that's also great, because you're still, even when you think that you're messing about, you're actually still learning a skill. I think, yeah, agency for teenagers is a massive thing.
So if you could wave a magic wand, where would you like to see yourself in 5 years' time?
Oh, wow. Oh, that's a scary thought, isn't it? I find, you know, I always have this like love-hate relationship with hope. It's heavy, right? And if you're hoping for it, it's because you don't have it. I think if I was going to wave a magic wand, I would like to be in a successful relationship. Like I've been married and divorced twice. I would like to, you know, like sometimes the thought that haunts me is like, I've come a long way and I know who I am now and I'm a very different human being than I have been up until this point. And all of the inner work, you know, like it's happening and I've come a long way. But at the same time, if I were to die today, I would never have known what it felt like to be loved. And that haunts me sometimes. So like that, I would like to be genuinely loved. I mean, there's other things, you know, and what I would love for my writing to be a huge success and to speak, have like greater chances to speak to people and connect with people. I would genuinely, as my like secret like thing is, I would genuinely really love to do, you know, like a Netflix or something, you know, like a show, not like a normal reality TV show, because I'm not really like a reality TV person, but something like that had a bit of life in it. Because I think one of the most important things actually you can do when you've survived abuse and people is not to let people only know you for that, because when they're then on that journey, they see that you've come through it, like let them actually see how life looks afterwards. Let them see, yes, when it's a struggle, yes, that it kicks you when you're down, but also that there is joy in it and that you can move forwards and have this like healed, fulfilled, abundant life. So I would like to, that would be my kind of thing that I would love to do. And then to be able to show people all of the creative projects that we as a family get involved in, And all of the things, and just I think I'm probably biased, but I just genuinely think that all of the people in my life are exceptional, and I think the way that they speak and the way that they are and the way that they carry themselves is inspirational, and I would love to be able to provide a space to share that with the world someday.
Can we talk about love a little bit? You spoke about the fact that you feel you've never truly been loved. Looking back on those two marriages, do you not feel that it was love that went sour rather than being loved?
No, I don't. I think the first time I got married, he and I both, we were young. I was 21, he was 23. And I think it wasn't that we didn't love each other, but it wasn't that kind of love, it was, we were friends and we cared about each other, but there was no real intimacy, but I think neither of us really knew better. And I think also we both were looking for this kind of white picket fence life that we had never had, and if we could find it and if we could build it, then maybe we would just feel a little bit less lost and a little bit less like we didn't have anywhere to belong, and we were in this very kind of Christian bubble when we met with youth workers and churches and all of the things, and we both I think felt like we were the two that stuck out like sore thumbs, and so we kind of clung to each other in that, and we tried to build this thing, and I think we had very good intentions and there was a kind of love there, but it wasn't the relationship, it wasn't the sort of love that really should have resulted in a marriage or a child. And then that leaving that relationship very much, that just turned my whole kind of worldview upside down, because as much as the reasons in hindsight that we were together were not what they should have been, I still very much got married thinking this is it forever. I absolutely never even had this tiny thought enter my mind that I might be a person who got divorced. Never mind that I would be the one that needed to leave, or that I wouldn't be able to cope, that I would be depressed and lonely and miserable and not wanting to get out of bed when I was married and I had a child. And I just thought, do you know what, in the end, I had a 2-year-old son, and I just thought, he needs a better version of me than this. And if I'm going to be this lonely, I might as well be alone. And I was really scared. And I thought everybody was going to judge me. And to be fair, some people were very judgy and very cruel, and they tried to shame me into staying. But the opinion I was most worried about was going to be my mom. She was very religious. And I was this one was scary for me. But when I mentioned it to her, she was she just said to me, I understand. And I was and I felt this kind of freedom to do that. But my whole worldview was very shaken. And I went on a couple of dates, but nothing that really came with it. I had a friends with benefits situation with a guy that I'd known since I was 11. And I just very quickly then met my second husband. And that was never, and to me, that was never even supposed to really be a relationship that got off the ground, but it got very serious very quickly. And it wasn't love. It was a manipulation. And it was, when you look back at it, understanding I didn't know anything about abuse at all, really, before that point. You have that inaccurate kind of, she got pushed down the stairs or punched in the face kind of TV version of it in your mind, and that's what you think it is. And I also just kind of naively thought I'm tough, and I'm gobby, if nobody's going to take advantage of me, nobody's going to do anything to me. And I didn't see it coming. And even when it was the things that to look at from the outside, when it comes to physical abuse or sexual abuse, you should be able to just if you were watching on TV, you'd be oh my goodness, that's abusive, get out. But when you're in it, it's so different, and you're so controlled that you don't know which way is up and which way is down. And when they tell it to you, it's your fault, you believe them. And so I was just, and that was very quickly, and the first time that he hurt me, It was just after we moved in very quickly because he had gone out to Africa. His parents were living in Tanzania. So he had gone out to stay with them, and all of the things that they were just kind of a lie in the circumstances. None of them were what I was told. But he said he would come back. My dad was going for an operation and I was living with my dad. And I needed to cover some work for him. He said, oh, well, I can help you with your childcare. And I just thought, oh, well, that's great. That's really kind. Thank you. I didn't really process that that meant that he would then move back to England and live with me and we would just live together. Like, we'd been on 3 dates and then I'd visited in Tanzania just for like it was Zanzibar. Who wouldn't visit? Like, you know, and then there was never any time to process any of the things. They were just one after the other. And then there was a miscarriage and then another miscarriage and then a pregnancy. And then we had to get married because we were pregnant and I never wanted to get married, but it was all of these things. And it was all so much so quickly, but it wasn't love. It was, he said the things I needed to hear, first of all. And I think a part of me knew really early on there were a lot of red flags, but I just did not have the strength to walk away from them, to face them. It was so much easier just to believe the things and to get through the day that way, that I just kind of allowed myself to. Like, the first time he hurt me, I was getting up from the table after dinner. I always like to have a cup of tea after dinner. So I'd finished eating before him and I went to stand up to put the kettle on. And I kind of grabbed my wrist and ground it into the table. But my dad was in the kitchen and it's kind of semi-open plan, sort of like a U-shape downstairs of the house. And he questioned it and I was so embarrassed that I was just like, oh no, it must have looked different than it was. He didn't hurt me, like not at all. I'm absolutely fine. And I just brushed it under the rug with it. And that was like the first thing very, very early on. And that set a precedent then, and things escalated. And especially then once we did get married while I was pregnant with my daughter, then that was, I wouldn't say it was flipping a switch because the signs were there, but they were amplified significantly once I think he felt like he had official ownership of me. So, I mean, no love. And I had a difficult childhood. And again, my parents are wonderful people and they did the best they can. But they're wonderful people now that they're in their 60s, like almost 40 years ago, they didn't really have any business bringing life into the world. They just were lost in their own struggles and not coping. So it's been complicated, but I have hope.
Can you maybe describe two or three red flags that you wish you had have looked out for? So somebody listening to this maybe might have a think about getting into a relationship.
Yeah, you know, like, I think it's really difficult. It's one of the things I find difficult now is that I can't tell when somebody is like ignoring me and when somebody is just being a normal like texter, like, because it was obsessive, like all the time, and then silent treatment, and it would go like hot and cold, and it would be everything in my whole life is about you in a very unhealthy kind of way, which when you're hurting and you feel worthless is very edifying and it's very flattering. And it's like a drug almost, you know, and you kind of then end up kind of addicted to that. That's how trauma bonding works. So there was very early on, there was like too much too soon. I think as well, I felt because everything moved so fast as well, by the time the stories I'd been told started to unravel, I felt like I was already trapped in it, like, and I didn't know that I could do anything about it. I would say one of the things for me as well, and it's hard because I don't have very much in terms of like a dating reference, you know, like I would say, obviously, like there's some obvious kind of red flags in terms of, you know, like how somebody treats the wait staff and stuff, but I didn't go through any of that with him. But I, like, very early on, he would say how much he loved me and how much he loved Lucas and how much all of the things, and he would say all of the things, he would do absolutely nothing, like, and it was all about how he looked to everybody else. So he would do absolutely nothing at home, and it wouldn't matter how big a struggle it was, how much was going on, he would never do anything for us. But if like a complete stranger that he met on the street or in the supermarket needed something, he would move mountains to give it to them, because then they would go out and tell everybody, oh, he's such a good guy, he's this and he's that, you know, like. But he would walk in the door, throw his bags down. I have like three kids by this point, one almost. So by the time I like left him, the last few months, the thing I remember most is just this issue that I had. And I just was like, why don't your actions make any sense to me? Like, he would come in and we would be expected like to greet him like at the door, and we would have to make him the priority, rush to see him. But I had like a 5-month-old baby, a 2-year-old and a 7-year-old, and he would come in at a meal time as I'm trying to prepare a meal. I've got a tired, grumpy baby like shoved up my sweater trying to feed it whilst I cook one-handed, a 2-year-old that's desperately trying to help with the cooking, a 7-year-old that's hungry. And he would come in and just be like angry that we didn't make it to the door in time to greet him as joyfully and enthusiastically. He would throw his stuff down and he would go to the pub like and just leave. And I would just be like, always questioned that, you know, like, if you actually love somebody, wouldn't you look at this situation and think, how can I help? Wouldn't you like take the baby or take over the dinner? Or, you know, like, and so I think it was that the actions and the words never quite met where they were supposed to. And I just think, generally, do you know what, if somebody tells you everything you need to hear, like, there's probably something wrong with that, because nobody actually really should be capable of delivering that. Like, they have their own needs and their own drama and their own history, and they're like, they shouldn't be able to just tell you, like, if it's too good to be true, like, it is too good to be true. Like, you have to actually believe that. And like, not, I think sometimes we, I think often we deep down know that we're looking at it with a rose-tinted view, but it's just easier that way and it's nicer that way. And it takes immeasurable strength to actually look at the cold, hard truth of a thing. And because it makes you examine yourself, because often the things that you don't want to deal with are things about yourself. And I think if you don't know what your green flags are, even ignoring all the red flags about somebody else, if you don't know what your green flags are, then you shouldn't be dating. You should take the time. I think if I could go back in time, you know, like to 20-year-old me, and just tell me, do you know what? Just like, wait until you actually know who you are before you try and like saddle your life up with somebody else. Red flags are, and I mean, and they're different for everybody. They're very different culturally and depending on your religion and where you live and what you as a person just like. So that's, it's kind of a minefield, but I think if you can know yourself and know what your green flags are, then your red flags are going to highlight themselves.
And now that you're doing the work and you've been through so much, are you at a point where you trust yourself getting into another relationship?
I hope so. Do you know what? Like, I think certainly there are a lot of things that I know I can trust myself with now. And I know, like, that I have learned that I can be brave enough to be vulnerable, and I can be honest even when I know it isn't what they want to hear. And I have moved past the point where I am willing to change myself to make somebody else happy. But I would also say, like, there has been a complicated friendship in the last 6 years that has stretched me and grown me, but hasn't been like an actual relationship. So I don't know, you know, until you're in a thing, it's hard to know. I've done the best I can on my own, but there does come a point in healing and discovering things. And also, you know, there's going to be, I expect that when I get into a relationship, that there's going to be flashbacks again. And, you know, because there are things that I haven't been in the position to be triggered by, so I don't know necessarily what they are at this point. I would say is, I know that I am brave enough to be vulnerable, and that I think I have learned that I have learned the level of capacity that I need another person to have. I have learned that I am complicated and that I am going to be a lot, but that a lot and too much are not the same thing. You just have to find the right person. Like, it always gets me when people say, oh, you're too much. Like, what do you want me to be, less? Like, in what world are we raising our daughters to go out and be less? No, you go and be more, and you find the people that can handle your splash, and you jump in and you go. Like, I'm never those people that think I'm too much. Like, I ain't got time for them. Like, so I just, whoever you are, whatever you are, if anybody's ever told you that you're too much, like, that's not about you. That's their lack of capacity and their insecurity. You just go out and you show them by becoming as much as you possibly can be. That's that.
When we get into a relationship, there's certain parts of it, I guess, that are public and certain parts that are private. And I think when someone isolates you, they probably do it gradually. But what's your view in terms of you getting into a new relationship and you sharing details of that relationship with your friends and significant people in your life?
This is where it's going to be interesting. Like, I, because I haven't really done that before. So I don't know, I think it's kind of exciting. I'm excited to be able to go to my best friend and be like, oh my goodness, I've met somebody and I'm excited and he this and this and this, and I'm not sure about that, but like, you know, like, and I do look forward to that. I don't know. I think for me, I will probably share a fair amount because I'm aware of my relationship history. And for me now, accountability is going to be important. And it comes back down to like the trusting yourself. Like, I have come a long way. But also, I would be unwise to just think, oh, I know all of the things now, I'm completely healed or whatever, and not, you know, like, history has a horrible way of repeating itself. And that is why we need community. That's why human beings are built to be in groups together. And I personally do feel like I need accountability. So I would be inclined, especially like early on, to share a lot with just like one or two very trusted people who I know are in healthy marriages, long-term relationships, and who are familiar with my trauma and my relationship history and my tendency to be a bit like all or nothing, and who can calm me down and hype me up where necessary, and to be like, I'm not sure about that. Like, and at this point, you know, if we went, I would want to at a certain point, you know, then go out for like a couple's dinner with my best friend and her husband. And if there was a point at which during that, by the end of that dinner, they were like, I don't think he's good for you, Weez, I would be inclined to trust their judgment more so than my own. Because it's very hard to see anything like when you're, that's not to say that I would let somebody just tell me you can't be with, you know, like, there is a line. But if you have the right people around you that know you, and know your trauma and know your history and who love you and desperately want to see you succeed, and they say, I don't think this person's good for you, like, I would be very remiss to not to take that too lightly. And yeah, accountability is going to be a big thing for me. I'm going to need that. And I'm going to have to also, to be fair, like, I think disclose that, you know, fairly early on in a relationship and be able to say, like, I'm not. Also, I think it's different for me, perhaps, because so much of my relationship history is now all over the internet. There are domestic violence. You've put my name in, you know, like, you can have a really in-depth abuse account of my relationship history, which is an unusual dynamic. So, but I think that maybe somebody that dated me would probably have a little bit more information than most people would. So that's complicated, but you have to be brave enough to share it, but maybe just you not in detail. I think you just need to give somebody a heads up without terrifying them, which is a complicated line, isn't it? It's different for everybody, but I think the tendency, it's one of those things that some people, and to be fair, possibly a red flag, though, like, if it was me, and it would be a red flag about me if I was to massively like overshare on the first date, that's a sign that I haven't healed properly. Like, because you're still feeling shame and you're kind of, you tend to have this kind of verbal diarrhea then, because you just want to put it all out there and be like, now accept me anyway, I dare you, kind of, you know, like, and that'd be a red flag. If somebody does that to you on a date, like, that's definitely a red flag too.
But I think, you know, you spoke to this before, saying that you really need to find people that accept the whole of you, your whole self. Otherwise, it's just not worth it.
And I think I haven't come this far now just to settle. Like, either, like, I'm actually, if anything, I worry sometimes I'm a bit too good at being on my own and it's safe. And the idea of, like, meeting somebody is wonderful and I want it, but it's also terrifying. You know, I'm very comfortable in my life, and comfortable is nice, but it's also, it's not good, is it? Like, it's good and not good all at the same time. We get too comfortable and then we end up complacent, or we don't grow. And I absolutely don't ever want to stop growing. I think we all have to make a commitment to be a lifelong learner. And otherwise we fall into all kinds of trouble that we didn't mean to. But I mean, we'll see. Hopefully soon. Who knows? It could be just around the corner.
Is there anything else you want to leave us with? Any advice you want to give people?
No, I think it just comes back to, like, know yourself. I think just make sure if you are on your own, take the time and don't be in a rush to find something because everybody else has it, or because even if you, like, really desperately want it, it's what you've always wanted. Like, the best gift I think that you can give your future partner, spouse, whatever, is to actually know who you are and where you're at and how you respond to things. And if you can tell them, you know, if they're going to raise their voice and you know yourself, and that's going to be a problem for you, and you know yourself well enough to actually be able to say, look, I need you to just take it down a level. I know you're not shouting, you're just from a loud family, but it's triggering for me because I've been through this. And you can actually explain yourself and how you're likely to respond to things to somebody when you're not triggered by it. And that's a really incredible gift to be able to give somebody, is to actually be able to help them to understand you, and for them to be able to do the same, and for them to, like, know themselves well enough. Like, that kind of effort has to be matched. You both have to be doing the work to understand each other, but you don't get to pick whether or not they're doing the work. You have to just do yours and then wait till you align with the right person at the right time in the right space with the right amount of effort.
Micropoetry offers a way to step back and consider life differently. So if that's something you'd like to try, Louise has kindly provided a free guide to step you through the process. We'd love to hear how you went and what you thought of this week's episode. You'll find the links in the show notes.
Now, dear listener, it's your turn. Have you got something to add to the conversation? Then get in touch via the links in the show notes. Whether you have questions, a message of support, or resources that you think might help, we'd love to hear from you. And if by chance you know someone with a story that will inspire others, be sure to let us know. Your contributions help turn inspiration into action, drive positive change, and make life just that little bit better. And if this conversation inspired you to expand your worldview, head to hellohuman.global to join the conversation.